a dual purpose, one to sort of celebrate Lecture Magazine, and then the second purpose is to sort of delve into one of the hot issues that Left Turn and this collective right here, a very large collective, has helped to raise about refugee solidarity. So we hope that this, you know, we're going to start off talking about the magazine a little bit and then transition to talk more about refugee solidarity. If it's hard to hear at any point, or is there mics right here? Yeah, I think we're going to try and steer clear, but if people can't hear, just let us know.
And that's okay for dance recording. You guys check?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So, my name is Francesca, and I work with Left Turn in New York. And I'm just going to go around this way and have everyone introduce themselves.
My name is Max. I'm another editor of Left Turn based here in New York City.
My name is Ishanti. I'm with Station Libre. Critical Resistance in Jericho.
My name's RJ. I've been working with Critical Resistance for a few years, and more recently, I'm part of a group of people organizing childcare, doing childcare work.
My name's Eric Tang. I've been involved in various movements over the past decade, mostly youth organizing stuff, and recently I've begun working with folks around building an activist resource center and training center called Refugio.
My name is Paula Rojas, and I'm part of a collective called Pachamama of mothers, low-income mothers of color in Brooklyn, and also work with Sister to Sister through those local things connected inside the national group of women of color inside.
I'm Dana Kaplan, and I've been working on criminal justice issues and issues of mass incarceration for the last several years in New York City and upstate New York. And right now, I'm working most with supporting an organization called Prison Families Community Forum, an organization of primarily women with loved ones in prisons, and also working out of the Center for Constitutional Rights on a campaign to end the contract between Verizon MCI and the Department of Correctional Services.
My name is Priscilla Gonzalez, and I'm a member of the collective of the Center for Immigrant Families, an organizing center uptown for low-income adult immigrant women of color.
Hi, my name is Adjo Jones Almeida, and I've spent 9 years working with the Sister to Sister Collective and recently have transitioned out. And I'm involved with the bedside daycare co-op called Little Maroons, and also with the community birthing project.
My name is Oju Agarwal, and I'm also part of the Center for Immigrant Families. And also I'm part of Refugio and the community birthing project.
Great. So, just to give you guys a little bit more background on Left Turn, Max and I are going to talk more about it, and just want to give an overview and pitch the magazine, this current, anniversary issue to y'all. Our feature is called Reflections on Resistance, 5 Years of Grassroots Reporting. So it features a section called Reflections on Resistance, which is mostly like a state of the movement section. So we ask authors to write about like their takes on specific movements. So there's a piece on the Palestine Solidarity Movement, a piece on the feminism movement, transgender activism movement. We also have a whole section on the prison industrial complex, and also a section on Latin America with analysis about the other campaigns, about Batista's new campaign, or their first campaign, and Venezuela, and Chile, and the Occupied Factories movement throughout Latin America. So, and of course, the editorial, Refugee Solidarity, by a few of these folks here. So that's what's inside, and I definitely encourage all who haven't seen it or don't have this issue to check it out back there. So Left Turn is a national magazine, and it's put together by 6 editors, and we're located in New York, D.C., New Orleans, and San Francisco.
And then there are about 15 to 20 people involved throughout the country in other cities also. And they're sort of small left-turn collectives, and they work on things like distribution or putting on local events and just sort of like doing that local work. All of the editors who work on the magazine are involved in a lot of the movements that we actually report on. So we're all activists, and we call ourselves sort of a movement publication because it's for activists and by activists. So people are involved in Palestine Solidarity Movement, the anti-war movement, the prison industrial complex, movement against the prison industrial complex, Latin American solidarity work that we're going to talk about tonight. And for the past 2 years, actually, since we moved from basically like a handful of people editing it, maybe like two or three, to an editorial collective of six, we've grown exponentially. And because we're a national organization or magazine, you know, we definitely have grown. And with all y'all help, you know, we've definitely grown. We doubled our print run. It's now 5,000, which is still small, but it's twice as much actually as 2 years ago. And in the past, year or so, we've increased our subscriptions by 70%, which is great. And we're in about like 200 bookstores in around the country, from like small info shops to Burns House Records, for example. So it's definitely been, it's been a great process of growing. And from coming from a place where none of us really knew about radical print media, you know, we've definitely learned a lot. And are far from where we started. But it's sort of, I guess, for where we started from, it wasn't necessarily all about radical print media, but more about the political project. And I think Max is going to talk about our roots in that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's funny. We were just having this conversation because we got invited to do some presentations at an upcoming media conference. And really, you know, we don't really see ourselves really as media activists. We don't really come out of this that world. It's kind of new to us. It's kind of scary to us. We see ourselves as activists that kind of inherited this publication and are just kind of excited to continue to kind of put out voices that are out there in the grassroots. Because as you know, most of the publications that are out there are either written by academics, scholars, or at least people who are sort of reflecting from afar on various movements, maybe with a few very good interviews, but rarely are those people on the front lines in terms of actually organizing in these various communities. And I think it's something that we try to bring to the forefront, that, you know, validating those people's experiences as writers, as authors, and as, you know, people that are able to really reflect on their own work without the need of intermediaries, you know, so-called professional writers. That doesn't mean we don't have great writers. A lot of our writers are really amazing. But, you know, we really, like, we kind of encourage, we encourage activists that maybe aren't always used to writing and putting their thoughts down to really kind of put that out there and to reflect and kind of see what happens with that. And then some, you know, writers, you know, we reflect to really be like, listen, if you want to write an article, you know, talk to the activists, talk to the people who are actually involved on the ground, talk to people in the community that people are organizing with, and get some of those voices. And so the magazine, you know, it's 5 years now. The first issue came out in 2001, right after the FTA protest, Free Trade Agreement of the Americas protest out in Quebec City. And part of the project initially was, you know, to kind of pull together what seemed like a new series of social movements that was on the rise globally, but also here in North America. And, you know, the question of how to do that, you know, and I think still, obviously, is kind of unknown. But I think one of the project of the magazine was like, how about we, you know, we start to get some of these voices down on paper and see kind of what they have to say. And I think, like, over the last 5 years, it's kind of, it has given voice to kind of a new generation of specifically younger radicals who are growing up and kind of reflecting out of practice and relationship to the work. And I think because of that, it's kind of like, you know, we're still suffering in terms of our distribution and everything else just because we're an all-volunteer collective and we don't have enough, like, you know, can't distribute through the mainstream distributors, and we can't get it out there still as much as we want. But we do do distribution just by local activists, basically just sending bundles of 20, 30, 40 to activists all across the country and all across North America, and they just kind of give it out to their friends usually, and that's just kind of how it goes. And so we suffer because we really hardly get any money back for it, but it actually gets out to people that we wanted to get it out to, and that's, in the end, that's what our project is. That's why it's a political project, because it's totally not self-sustaining as a media project, but it is self-sustaining as a political project and giving people kind of a resource to use. So I guess the last thing quickly I'll just say in this sentence, this little part, is that I think one of the, I don't know, maybe the one of the reasons for our success, or one of the things that we surely try to put out there, is we try to bridge like this tension between the kind of hopeful optimism that I think the publication came out of in 2001. You know, the optimism of the Zapatistas, of the battle of Seattle, around work that's been moving forward for the last 10, 15 years. And putting that together with the very real and very scary kind of post-September 11th climate in this country. But always kind of straddling the two and never, you know, never just putting out a forecast of doom and gloom, but making basically an accessible publication that highlighted really what work was being done against this, as opposed to just simply an analysis of all the problems that was out there. And I think that kind of general like ray of optimism and focus on the work has, I think, maybe differentiated us, you know, a little bit from some of the other print publications, which are really suffering across the board. As all of you know, print media is totally on the way out. Everyone gets their news off the internet, and so even just to have a print publication right now, it's really challenging.
And just to continue off of that, specific movements that we focus on are movements in Latin America and the Middle East. It's particularly, I mean, in terms of, you know, spanning that same optimism, but also, like, reality of the war on terror, right? Looking at, like, the optimism of the social movements in Latin America and the Zapatistas, but then trying to play a role of demystifying the Middle East and actually finding the, you know, the social movements, the progressive social movements that are often, you know, not seen by the left. And really finding those writers to, like, pull out those stories and give the left sort of an analysis and a framework within which to think and to not reduce it and not be reductive, but see the Middle East and the politics of the Middle East as you know, as complex and things that we need to just delve into and not shy away from, especially in this time of, like, anti-Arab racism and Islamophobia and all of that. So I think that's another role that we like to play that too few publications are doing right now. And I guess the last thing is, second to last thing is that, you know, these events are just as much a part of our project and, you know, going beyond the printed word and the internet and our e-communication, you know, the value of really having these face-to-face spaces in which to build relationships and just to dialogue with one another. There are too few and far between, so we hope that tonight will contribute to that. And do you wanna end
it off? Yeah, I mean, I guess I was just gonna end this introductory section maybe just by reading a few. How are we doing on time? Are we?
Do you wanna talk about
that? Yeah. Well, I mean, we, you know, one thing with the magazine that we shy away from is kind of editorializing and kind of putting like the thoughts of the editors out there in every issue like beforehand. Like, this is what we think, and this is how you need to build. Right. At the same time, you know, a lot of people over the years have asked us, well, you know, what are your politics? Where are you coming from? Are you just putting this out there? You're just kind of putting stories of resistance out there. You say you're a political project, what is the political project? You know, and so for this anniversary issue, I think one initial step that we tried to make towards, you know, explaining that in some way is trying to come up with our 5-year anniversary editorial, which we were really happy about how it worked out. And I was just going to read a little bit of it, just because it's kind of the culmination of a lot of the editor's kind of thoughts and stuff like that, and kind of reflects more what the collective thinks more than what me and Francesca right now can kind of tell you ourselves. So I guess just the last section, the last two subsections, which are Revolution and Hope in the Dark. Under the Revolution section, it goes, there are many challenges facing the left today, in the U.S. today. In order for us to move forward, it is important to have a sober assessment of the political terrain. It is equally important, however, that we do not fall into the trap of defeatism and demobilization. We do not need to put our hopes into the lesser of two evil political parties. We do not need to compromise our larger vision for a series of short-term reforms. As Robin D.G. Kelly writes, we still need freedom dreams. We still need revolution. What this revolution would look like is still far from clear. Like many of today's social movements around the globe, we've rejected the notion of the vanguard party structure as a means to liberate ourselves, as well as the path of social democracy and electoral politics. There's indeed no paved road to revolution, but many unbeaten trails that we've yet to walk. Past attempts at revolution have shown us that true freedom and liberation cannot be imposed nor granted from above. They must grow from grassroots organizations of people controlling and running their own communities, schools, workplaces, and lives. Therefore, at Left Turn, like much of the global justice movements, we commit ourselves to democratic and non-hierarchical organizing as a core building block for any truly radical change.
Okay, I'm gonna end it with our hope in the dark section. So finally, we wish to project a politics of hope, inspiration, and solidarity based both on the rich history of social movements and the visionary work of everyday people coming together to radically transform society. We live in dark times, but it is important to remember that we have the power to chart another course. There is widespread resentment of the Bush administration and the larger political establishment that we can build on in the coming months. The government's criminal response to Hurricane Katrina domestically and the ongoing disastrous occupation of Iraq abroad has made ruling class priorities quite clear to millions of people. The challenge for us is not to simply keep pointing out how bad everything is for people. We have to be capable of building movements that those people actually want to be a part of and feel like they can help shape. For our part, we will continue to provide forums for cross-movement dialogue, debate, and analysis. And we hope that over the years, Left Turn will continue to be a resource to this movement of movements, reflecting and encouraging relevant revolutionary politics and visions in the struggle for a better world. So thanks, y'all, for coming out. And I'm going to turn it over to Dana.
Well, first of all, I'm sure that we all want to thank Left Turn for organizing this and hosting us tonight. And I'm just going to kick it off by talking a little bit about what exactly the Rethink Solidarity series was that brought us here, and just a little bit about why it is that we even thought that solidarity as a notion is something that we had to rethink. Over the last couple years, a lot of different organizers, community organizers who do a lot of local work, went to a few different countries in the Global South on various delegations, to Brazil, to Venezuela, to Chiapas, to Argentina, and, you know, other places as well, kind of to participate in a lot of the different international forums that have been going on, the World Social Forum, the World Youth Festival, and also do kind of solidarity movement building work. And, you know, this idea of going to the Global South, I don't think is a new thing at all. Obviously, this has been going on for years, rooted from North America. But I think that we can say that it's picked up a little bit with all these different international forums that have been coming together. And we thought that it was time to kind of create a space to really reflect on that a little bit more critically and say, what does it mean for us to be taking these delegations to other countries, and how does that more critically impact our work that we're doing here in the United States? And so that was kind of the precedent for the series. And we started that dialogue by hosting a four-part series in a community space in Brooklyn, Refugio, which has been mentioned a couple times, which was basically a way to come back, to kind of share the actual stories of what we experienced, and then dialogue a little bit further on what the relevance of that was. And kind of in that vein is how we're opening up the space tonight, just to kind of continue that critical dialogue. And so, I guess, again, the second part of that question is why we think solidarity and why is this such a critical dialogue, is that, you know, the idea of solidarity is also not something that's a new thing. And, you know, that's something that kind of has a lot of different historical roots, whether it's an idea of solidarity amongst working classes, you know, white workers in solidarity with workers of color, from workers from oppressed communities, whether that's solidarity kind of looking at a global level, starting from, you know, here where you are and looking out. There's a lot of different definitions. I Googled it before I came here, and the definition that I found via the Google form was different groups of people coming together around common interests, common values, and common goals. And I like that. I think that that's something that, you know, resonates with people. But at the same time, I think that we kind of have to look a little bit more deeply at what that means. You know, common values, common goals, and different people are all actually pretty loaded terms that can obscure a lot. And I think that's kind of what brought us to this table. And, you know, I can speak, I think, first from just my own positionality, which is that as a white woman coming into left organizing and coming into organizing on social justice issues, when I first heard the word solidarity as kind of a way of organizing our work, I had strong reactions against it. Because for me, what solidarity has always evoked has been this idea of, you know, people with privilege going to the third world to help out the folks in Chiapas when they have a harder time going to Corona, Queens to really figure out what's going on there, you know? People doing relationship building with folks in the Global South, yet having a harder time doing relationship building with the people who live a block away from them in Bed-Stuy in their new neighborhood. You know, I think that I've thought about a lot about, you know, solidarity meaning people who go to Nicaragua in the 80s when maybe what we needed to have been doing was organizing against policies in the U.S. that impacted Nicaragua. I've thought about, you know, the history of the new left kind of giving up a little bit on the U.S. working classes and then building solidarity with people outside the U.S. You know, I hear solidarity, and some of the first things that I think of right now is something, a movement like the International Solidarity Movement in Palestine. And that's not to slam on the International Solidarity Movement in Palestine. I have tremendous respect for the work that they do, and have contributed to that work. But at the same time, I know that the people in Palestine are saying, so how come all the people that come to Palestine from the United States are white? And do they think that the only role that they have to play is chasing around tanks? You know, the West Bank is in Seattle. And so these are some of the questions in terms of solidarity that I think that we have to ask before we really get at what it actually means. But that's not to say that solidarity itself is problematic or that we need to redefine solidarity. I just think that we need to kind of interrogate it a little bit more. And what I'm certainly not saying is that white folks in the U.S. shouldn't be in solidarity. And in fact, I think if anyone needs to be organizing in solidarity, it's certainly the community that I come from. But I think that, you know, there's a level in which we just need to be more critical about what that means, what that looks like, and make sure that when we talk about solidarity, we're not doing it in a way that kind of reflects the worst dynamics of our movement. And I think that those, you know, those dynamics of our social movements and of our kind of left communities here in the United States, our internal racism that privileges white folks as leading the movement, solidarity work that is normally defined in a way that leaves it in the hands of those that can afford plane tickets, those that work in nonprofits, those that don't need to struggle at home to the same degree, and those that, you know, are really prioritizing, again, their relationship building in Venezuela, in Brazil, in Cuba, wherever the new revolutionary hotspot is, without really thinking about what it means to prioritize relationship building with the struggles that are going on in New Haven or East Oakland or Mott Haven or any of the other places where there's also really important work going on. You know, I think there's a lot of lefty tourism that goes on, but not enough work. And I guess that, you know, part of this is just kind of the call to engage a little bit more in what are the harder aspects of this solidarity work. And I guess I kind of opened up the conversation with some of the harder questions about it, maybe because it's also the issues that I grapple with. You know, I'm not positioning myself outside of the question of what is solidarity. I think that, you know, 6 months in Cuba in the year 2000 probably changed my life, and I participated in these delegations with, you know, people here, other people in the room, and others to Venezuela, to Brazil, and to Palestine, and I think that, you know, that was important political work. So it's not, you know, it's not to just dismiss this kind of realm of political action, but it's kind of in the spirit of taking it beyond the place in which we've been able to have this dialogue, and I think move us closer towards the goal of really being in a genuine solidarity that, you know, starts from here and moves outward and really gets us to the type of liberation that I guess we're all talking about. So that's kind of what began to bring us together in this room. Thank you, Sean.
stop laughing. First off, I am quite impressed by this crowd. If I can put that in there, you know. Quite impressed by the crowd, right? And very diverse, even in terms of age. My peers are in here. You know, I feel more comfortable now. I'm not just up here with them folks. How many people here are from the, was part of movements in the 50s and 60s? See, that's what I'm talking about. the thing about what we're doing is it's like Frantz Fanon, I think, said something about every generation got to grapple with these questions around what is revolution and all this other stuff. And, I mean, we did our thing back then, and we dealt with some of these things. We called it solidarity or whatever. You know, we was trying to figure out what was the relationship that we had being from here to other struggles, whether it was in Vietnam, Mexico, Middle East, Africa, whatever. But it's never done in isolation. I mean, whatever struggle overseas that we are trying to find a way to support, it always brings us back to what's going on here, which is why I really like the focus of this, because what concerns me most being, from my position, being like black revolutionary trying to create conditions for the liberation of black folks here, I'm just as much concerned with what is the relationship between white activists to my struggle, as well as what is all of our relationships with trying to end the Vietnam War. And we was trying to deal with all of these questions, and sometimes I think we did well, and sometimes we did very bad. But the thing is that there's no ready-made answers for it. Every generation has got to figure out how to do it better. So it means you got to re-examine stuff. You know, you got to re-examine the concepts like she's talking about, or we're talking about rethinking solidarity. We really do. And we're also talking about rethinking revolution. We really do. You know, and we got to even question whether the old understandings of them things were good or effective. Well, maybe they were at some time in history, you know. But it is really courageous to, like, question it when everyone around you sometimes gives off the air of assuredness that, well, you know, this is already written. We already know how to do this. This is the proper relationship. But I can tell you that even during towards the end of the Vietnam War, a lot of us in the black movement felt like we were kind of rejected. We were kind of left hanging by a lot of movements that, which we might call white movements, the left or whatever. And so solidarity for us didn't feel like solidarity. Folks wanted to put a lot of pressure on us in terms of how we should conduct our struggle. And, I mean, the Black Panther Party gets a lot of attention now, but, I mean, like, because we took it to the point of being willing to use weapons, it made a lot of people decide how they wanted to relate to us. Solidarity then became, you know, people imposing nonviolent standards on us, civilized standards on us, everything. And our struggle seemingly was different from what was going on with the Vietnamese and the African liberation movements and the Asian liberation movements. Why was ours different? So those struggles overseas, because a lot of us had a chance to go there, I wasn't one of them, but a lot of folks now had a chance to travel, they were bringing back these lessons from these other struggles. And they always raised the question, what was the best way to support them? And I know that there was one point where the Black Panther Party had went to the People's Republic of the Congo. And this might have been like early 70s. And when Eldridge Cleaver and others asked the leaders of the People's Republic of the Congo what was the best way that we over here could help them, they said, do your own struggle. The best way that you can help us here in the Congo is to create more struggles within the United States for your own liberation. That's what the Zapatista said, you know? So why are we still grappling with the same questions? It seems like now people have better understandings of what solidarity more effective solidarity might mean. They throw out terms like horizontal solidarity. New, you know, posing something different of a way to give solidarity that is not, doesn't have that parental air to it or that exploitative air, that privileged air that you might even recognize. So, I mean, we're in a situation today that we can make some advances over a lot of mistakes that we made in the 50s and the 60s. Not only to support movements overseas, but supporting those movements right here within the United States. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if some of you remember, but a lot of our analysis back then was like the black community was like an internal colony of the United States. The Chicano people, Aslan, was like an internal colony of the United States. Just here, not overseas. And we wanted this, a kind of relationship with others within the United States that would recognize our struggles, respect our struggles. No struggle overseas, okay? No struggle overseas can we get away from reflecting on what's going on here with us face to face, with all of our issues here. And that's what I think is the important thing about this. Mm-hmm. I got tapped in.
So, before I begin and offer some of my comments, I just wanted to, again, recognize Left Turn and congratulate them on 5 years. I can't be early in 5 years. I've only been reading League 2, by the way. So, how about a round of applause for Left Turn? One thing they immodestly left out of their intro was that they were also some of the brains behind the Life After Capitalism conference that happened right before the RNC and that received a 4-star review from the New York Post. So, so we should be thankful for that as well. And you're not just loved, Left Turn, in here at home in the United States. They love you in Chile too. A little anecdote before I begin. I was down there during the elections, and I needed some press credentials, but I needed to belong to a press. So I said, okay, Left Turn. And then Max was kind enough to whip off a letter to the Ministry of the Press, and I got my credentials. So the U.S. press was ABC News, CNN, McNeil Lair, or just McNeil Lair, I'm not sure, the PBS channel, and then Left Turn. And then when they talked to the U.S. press corps, they were like, well, who wants to ask a question of the president? Left Turn? They were fascinated by the name. And I was, of course, scared shitless. So I said, no, give it to the guy from ABC. My Spanish isn't quite good enough. Anyway, so, on that note, when we got together for the Rethinking Solidarity series, one thing that I think is important to mention is that we were looking at the hemisphere. We were saying, okay, what's happening in Latin America, throughout the Americas, that seems like a pattern? And that's another kind of element that I think helped frame our discussion, you know, picking these countries that obviously we went to, but there was a reason. It wasn't just random. I think it's because of its proximity and also because these developments, at least as they're understood by the people in Latin America, these developments are a pattern of a shift, a collective shift that's happening across nation states in South America. So we're in these discussions, and after, you know, 3 or 4 of these events, a couple of themes begin to emerge. And I want to just kind of rattle off what those themes are. There are 3 that stand out. And the first one is that solidarity really means getting our movement together here in the U.S. And I think Dana and Shanti have already elaborated on that. It means really getting or organizing our movement tightly focused and unified here. 2, it means being open to a number of tactics and strategies, meaning that we're not here to claim authority over what solidarity is and what it ain't, but we're saying that just as, you know, the movement in Venezuela is very, very different than what you're seeing in Mexico, we have to be open to the idea that solidarity doesn't mean kind of adopting or enlisting one strategy over the other and then having these endless line struggles over what strategy is best, but really being open to the possibility that local communities are going to naturally have distinct strategies and tactics, and we can learn and apply different ones at different times. And the third theme that came out of the discussion is that those of us who want to be in solidarity, and many of us who joined the discussions were folks who had on-the-ground work in grassroots communities in New York for several years, those of us who want to be in solidarity have to see our own faiths here as inextricably tied to the faiths of people abroad. And that, I think, was a qualitative difference that maybe set this discussion apart from other discussions around solidarity, meaning that we saw ourselves and our futures as precarious and unstable, that we're not coming from a place where we know that we're going to be living the standard of living we're living for the rest of our lives, that things are going to be stable as they are now, or not. But we see ourselves as vulnerable, and that the struggles that are happening abroad, the physical struggles, are tied to our own faiths. And, you know, I want to elaborate on that last point because I think it brings together all three points. One of the things that, you know, can happen when you talk about rethinking solidarity is you kind of introduce yourself as the group that's rethinking it, and all of a sudden it's new, right? This idea that we're talking about a new kind of solidarity where our faiths are tied to the people abroad. But quite frankly, it's not new. People of color solidarity with struggles abroad, particularly in third world communities, is at least, you know, a tradition that's lasted the entire 20th century. And as an example, in 1946, there was a group called the Congress of African Affairs, and it was led by African-American leaders such as Paul Robeson, and their focus was looking at Africa, and particularly South Africa, and what was happening around apartheid and the colonization of South Africa as intimately linked to the struggle for African-American freedom here. And in 1946, they had 19,000 people at Madison Square Garden who were part of their base. 19,000. And these weren't just folks who just floated in, you know, let me check out what's going on with the CAA. These were voting members who voted on issues such as a resolution denouncing apartheid and the past system in South Africa in 1946. To think that you had 19,000 people in a time where the African-American population was significantly smaller than it is now in New York, all people of color, doing solidarity work is a pretty amazing concept. So what we're trying to do with rethinking solidarity is pretty humble, and it's certainly not new. And the CAA is an interesting example because, again, they saw themselves not as saying, okay, what can we do as, you know, subjects and citizens of the United States, but what could we do, you know, as people who are global citizens to address this issue? And they really saw their faiths as tied to what was happening in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And I think, in closing, the immigrant rights movement that we're seeing right now, before I get kicked again, is, and everyone's just astonished, wow, where did all these hundreds of thousands of immigrants, you know, come from? Well, I mean, it's, what I think we have to understand is that a lot of the folks who are taking to the streets see their futures as tied to what's happening in their homelands. It's that urgency, it's that sense that, you know, we can't take for granted being here, that we are actually global citizens and not firmly rooted with the privileges that are afforded by U.S. citizenship. I'm done. Next.
Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of the things that through our series and the reflections that came out on the political shifts in the Americas, since that was our focus, and then kind of the lessons that we drew out of that for ourselves and our work here. And so if we're saying what Ashan has said and what others have said, that we're talking about a solidarity that is horizontal, right? That isn't about just what we can, US-based, even local organizers, like how we can support people in other countries. So we're, you know, we are in the brain of the monster, the belly of the beast, and we do have privilege. So it's not to say that that isn't part of the role, our role, and also part of solidarity, but the horizontal solidarity is also the support that we can get for our work here from what's happening in other places, and to really take that piece as really important in solidarity. And if anything, we're getting a lot more out of this relationship than other folks are when people go to Latin America to be like an observer in a, you know, autonomous Zapatista territory that, you know, looks, has a lot of blonde hair, so that when the plane goes, you know, passes by, they're like, yo, we're not going to hit up this community because we got these observers this week, so we're going to leave them alone, right? That's a real thing that people do that's useful. But what we're saying about horizontal solidarity is we have a lot more to benefit in these relationships than we think, and we have a lot more to benefit than we are kind of admitting to ourselves or being open enough to learn from. So part of that is kind of looking at the political shifts happening and drawing some lessons from that to what we're doing here on the day-to-day. So I'm going to put out kind of a very general, some of the political shifts that we've noticed, so that a lot of these revolutionary movements from 30, 40 years ago that were doing revolutionary, their movement was about challenging and contesting state power, right? Either through, a lot of times through armed struggle, to topple that state power and replace it with another kind of power, right? That a lot of those either didn't work out, or when they did work out in a few instances, didn't really bring the profound kind of revolution that maybe the people were hoping to bring. And so a lot of lessons of those folks have been to rethink how to build power, not so much as taking over state power, but as thinking about power is also the power that we build with each other, and that starts to become creating autonomy, creating our own power that divests from state power, and that in itself is as much of a challenge to the state as trying to fight to topple the state, right? So that is one kind of shift in a lot of different places in Latin America, not all, obviously, but there's, in almost every single country, there's these autonomous movements building in different ways. Another one of the kind of lessons around these shifts is that in that, it isn't just like strategically smarter politically around the power shift, but it's also the way that we're so good at knowing what we're against, right? We're fighting against all of these things that we're spending so much energy doing that we don't really have the time or the energy or the creativity or the practice to think about what we're for. So let's say we win the revolution tomorrow, right? How the fuck are we going to do things? Like, what are we going to do? How are we going to do education? We know it's messed up right now. We talk about it. But how would we do it ourselves? Do we know? How would we do healthcare? How would we do childcare? You know, we're so good at trying to point out how the institutions are doing it wrong, but we don't have the time to develop that. Folks are doing that now and are learning through that process. That's another kind of lesson for us. And then another would be to really look at how politics is being done as people got disillusioned from political parties and just kind of inherent hierarchies, kind of formal hierarchies, formal and informal hierarchies in different kinds of political formations, to really create, not new, but refocus on doing things that would build horizontal power and horizontal relationships, and really kind of push themselves to doing these asambleas populares or consultas, which might seem crazy to us, before making a big decision to fucking talk to every single person in your movement and take 2 years, if it takes 2 years, and then you make the big old move, right? So to really see here where a lot of times people are like, oh, you can only do that in a small little collective, but it's too messy, too time-consuming once you have a bigger group of people. People are doing it with, like, way more people than we've ever been organizing with, and it works, right? And for some of us here in the Community Birthing Project, Sister to Sister, Pachamama, groups of working with working class women of color in particular, I feel like another lesson for us that we drew was that for us to be kind of important participants in social movements is not that we need to act like a white male worker and get in there and, like, we're going to go and do the same kind of fight that they're doing, but in our color and our gender, but that even that
from who we are and how we live is also another place to struggle from. And we don't have to extract ourselves from our lives to go be political, but that we make what our life is on the day-to-day the political act, right? Mm-hmm. So that, for me in my day-to-day practice, is one of those lessons, but of seeing people saying it isn't just leaving the community and going to the mountains and getting training or whatever movement way you're going to build, but it's that everyone in the community, children, elders, you know, mothers, everybody is an active person in that movement, because by building this community, that's how you're building the movement, you're building power, so everyone gets to be involved in that. So, and then the last thing I'll say on that is also just from a lot of us doing local grassroots organizing here, feeling like if you really want to build a real base, you know, you really got to be involved in these. It's not because we like it, but, you know, you got to do the nonprofit thing. You need the time, you need the paid time, you need the grants, you need to get the permit from the cops to march against the cops. Because we don't have choice, because that's just the conditions here. Because if we were to just have to be like everybody else, to have a day job and then do our political shit on the side, we just wouldn't have enough hours to build a significant base. So those people that do it on their volunteer stuff, you know, they don't have big enough base. And then we're to really realize that that's not true, and that there's movements that are building, you know, at a mass level way beyond anything that we're building here in the United States right now. And they ain't part of the, you know, nonprofit, and they're not getting a grant to run it, right? So some of those shifts and lessons were some of the stuff that kind of brought us to the conversation of rethinking solidarity. Some of the stuff that, like, we drew out of looking at examples from different countries. And then also the stuff that we told ourselves, like, we really, in this horizontal solidarity conversation, we have a lot to learn. And yes, conditions are different here in the U.S. than in other places, but we're actually pretty lucky to be in these dialogues, you know, and to not even necessarily travel, but just be able to kind of engage people who are, right now, if we look continentally, like, in a much more advanced place of struggle than we are here, right? And so that was another reason why reshifting how we do the solidarity and kind of put ourselves more in the learner position is so important.
So I was going to kind of build off of what folks have already started to talk about, but there's actually, I think, a lot of overlap, so I'll keep it short. Part of what we really talked about in this coming together of this series was to really learn and share and hear about what is happening in Latin America right now. What are these social movements that are taking over Latin America now that have been doing this work for a while? And as people have said, what is our relationship to these folks? But also, as people have said, how does these movements inform our struggles here? And I think that there were, just like we started to talk about how do we rethink this concept of solidarity, one of the lessons that we started to think about during this series is how do we start to rethink kind of critical themes that all of these movements are starting to rethink too. So, for example, the Zapatistas in Mexico and other indigenous groups that are struggling for autonomy there have really shifted, have really turned on its head the whole concept of power. You know, they have a really interesting analysis of power that is totally different from the way that we've been kind of trained to think about it here. And what does that mean for us here? You know, or for example, after the economy collapsed in Argentina and movements like the unemployed workers movement started to take hold there, they started having a really interesting analysis of what does it mean to be political? What does it mean to do politics? And all of a sudden, a very interesting, and not necessarily homogeneous, you know, but very interesting new understandings, as folks have talked about, started to emerge around that. Is being political going out there and marching, you know, with a or picketing, or is being political, you know, the way you think about childcare within a community, or the way that a community comes together to meet its own needs in a very day-to-day way. Is that political work? Is that doing politics? You know, what does resistance look like? As folks have already kind of talked about, is resistance just going out there and fighting against institutions? You know, in the case of Brazil, for example, the landless workers movements have come up with a very different model of doing resistance that is not just about pressuring institutional power, but is about actually creating parallel autonomous societies. So that's a very different way of approaching resistance than the way we've been conditioned to think about resistance in this country. So I think that So we really spent some time talking about and learning about what is happening in Chiapas right now, what is happening in Brazil around the landless people's movement right now, what is happening with the unemployed people's movement in Argentina right now. And one of the things that we found is that, as folks have said, very different things are happening. There isn't one kind of, you know, model that we can just, you know, bottle up and start promoting, you know, here or anywhere else. But that in itself was a very critical lesson that we started to discuss, which is, what is this impulse that we have to have the answer, to have it marketed nicely and neatly, and to start disseminating it? And what does it mean to not have that, and to be coming in contact with folks that are saying, actually, what is interesting is the conversations that we're having. So, for example, the unemployed workers folks, there's no, and this is very different from the landless people's movement in Brazil, because the landless people movement is in some ways hierarchical. You know, it's a national organization. You have local chapters. You have yearly congregations where all the representatives come and meet and things are decided. Whereas in Argentina, the unemployed people's movement, There's no one hierarchical structure. You have many locally based organizations that have very different visions of how they're engaging people around education, how they're engaging people around the many money-making projects that they have, you know. And they and some of those folks are interested in building a more homogeneous vision of what they stand for, and other folks are not interested in that at all, and are more interested in building autonomous small communities that are talking, that are dialoguing, but that are refusing to have just one line or one structure that they all kind of fall under. So these are all the things that we were trying to kind of like pull out and pull apart and say, wow, so what does this mean? Understanding that the real solidarity work is about us shaking shit up in here, you know, so that folks there are not under so much pressure, but that also so that we can start to create cracks in this empire from within here. So then what does that mean for us here? What lessons can we pull? And how can we start to imagine what it would mean to actually apply some of these lessons? And I think that just to speak from my personal experience, what this has meant for me has been A, trying to move away from being paid to do organizing or political work. And I'm not saying this is what people should be doing at all. You know, and it's not feasible. I mean, you have to be in a position of privilege to be able to even in some situations do that, but not necessarily. Like as Paula pointed out, people do it in Latin America all the time, and they have a huge mass movements that you could say here have been totally co-opted by the way that we've become professional activists. So, but for me, it's been the struggle to think about what would it mean for me to continue to be committed to doing locally based work, but not be paid to do it, you know. So that's one thing. Another thing has been to really think about what is most critical in my life right now. Well, what's critical in my life right now has been issues of childcare, has been issues of of how children enter spaces that are about building community and building a political vision, and how we think about education, not just at the level of classrooms, but in the level of community, you know? So, wow, these are the critical issues in my life right now. Okay, so how do I engage with people around that? Not just to create pressure around all the kind of messed up institutional, you know, legislation aimed at making it so that people don't have access to childcare and have a fucked up education, all that. Although that's critical and important too. But how can we also start to imagine what we want, you know, on a day-to-day level? And how can I shift my perspective on resistance and start to structure my work around building and imagining as opposed to just criticizing and tearing down? And where does the economics piece around, you know, funding play into that? So that's kind of a very all over the place thing, but hopefully we'll have a chance to interact more and dialogue more.